ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 नमो विश्वराय कृष्णप्रसाद बुद्धदे श्रीमारे भक्तिवरांत स्वामी जी नामने नमस्ते सरस्वत देव गौरवाणी प्रचारण नर्वशिशन्यवाणी श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभुश नंद श्री वैदगराधा श्री वसुदे गौरवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे हे कृष्ण बाबा कैंटो वन चैप्टर सेवन वर्स 45 स तेज भगवान द्रोण प्रजा रूपेण वर्तते यस्यात्मानोर्ध्वं पत्न्यास्ते नान्वगाभिरसुकृतिः स एष भगवान् द्रोणः प्रजारूपेण वर्तते यस्यात्मानोर्ध्वं पत्न्यास्ते नान भगत भी रसु कृपि सी ऐसा सर्टनली भगवान लॉर्ड द्रोणा द्रोणाचार्य प्रजा रूपेणा इन द फॉर्म ऑफ द सन अस्तताम Vartate is existing. Tasya is Atmana of the body. Ardham, half. Patni, wife. Aste, living. Na, not. Under God, undertook. Avirasu, having the sun present. Kripi, the sister of Kripacharya. Translation, he, Dronacharya, is certainly still existing, being represented by his son. His wife, Kripi, did not undergo sati with him because she had a son. Prabhupada, the wife of Dronacharya, Kripi, is the sister of Kripacharya, a devoted wife who is, according to revealed scripture, the better half of her husband, is justified in embracing voluntary death along with her husband if she is without issue. But in the case of the wife of Dronacharya, she did not undergo such a trial because she had her son, the representative of her husband. A widow is a widow only in name if there is a son of her husband existing. So in either case, Aswatthama was the representative of Dronacharya. And therefore killing Aswatthama would be like killing Dronacharya. That was the argument of Draupadi against the killing of Aswatthama. Translation, he, Dronacharya, is certainly still existent, being represented by his son. His wife, Kripa, didn't undergo sati with him, because she had a son. This is one reason for not wanting Aswatthama killed. One aspect is that he represents father, and even though Aswatthama is sinful, he still represents the father who was not sinful, Dronacharya. So in that sense, better we don't kill him, because it's like killing Dronacharya. The other point, of course, is that Dronacharya's wife did not commit sati but stayed alive because the son was alive. But if the son has killed, then she has no purpose in living again, so then she probably has to commit sati, but it's a little bit late for that. So, in this sense, the killing of Aswatthama would be grief, a cause of grief for Kripa. So therefore, there is some hesitation to carry out this act.
So these are, we can say, reasons from normal relationships, point of view of relationships, because of causing grief, etc., or because of respecting a brahmana, even if the son is not a good brahmana, the father is a good brahmana. So these are some of the reasons that can be raised. Just as in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna raises points why you shouldn't kill the enemies, particularly those who are relatives or those who are teachers or gurus, because there's, you know, shastric regulations for giving respect. And as I mentioned yesterday, the teacher has to be given proper respect, otherwise knowledge is not transmitted properly. So that respect will be there in all cases, even if the person's on the wrong side. And in this case we have Bhishma and Dronacharya on the wrong side of the war. Still, they have to be respected. So the problem comes is if you fight and you have to kill them, how you can respect them and kill them at the same time? So we get problems like this. So though the scriptures give us rules, sometimes it gets a little complicated because of the particular situations in the material world, which no one can predict. There are infinite number of, you know, conditions in the material world which scripture will not talk about. So therefore we get into these positions and get puzzled by them, as Arjuna was puzzled. So it is some genuine cause of bewilderment, whatever, when we fall into these particular situations. So this is so in the material world, not only, of course, with the Vedic rules and regulations, but even in normal society, we have a set of rules and then a new situation comes up and we don't know how to apply the rules. Yeah. For instance, something like abortion comes up, so then there's pluses and minuses for abortion, and that there wasn't such a thing before, so nobody thought about it. But then when science advances and then they have these abilities to do things, then a problem like this comes back. And then there's a whole problem of what is life arises, or when does the child exist, or whatever, or what rights do a child in the womb have. So we get all sorts of problems like this, and they're rather unsolvable in many ways, because there's no precedent for them in the rules given by the country, and then you have to make new rules, which may be wrong, because our next generation may have different circumstances, and again, so it's all relative. So the same case here is with the Vedic rules. We have rules and regulations, and still how to apply them properly. It requires great wisdom to do that. Okay. So ultimately, of course, we find that Krishna gives a solution to this, a very clever solution, which satisfies everyone. So we do have rules and regulations like this, but ultimately the principle beyond all of this is that to solve our problems we have to surrender under the Supreme Lord. This is the ultimate solution to everything. So that's the solution to Arjuna's problem in Bhagavad Gita. You can have so many arguments, plus or minus, this way or that way, fight, not fight, or whatever. The ultimate issue is whether you're surrendered to the Lord or not. And if you're surrendered to the Lord, that takes care of everything. the other things don't matter. Whatever happens, fight or not fight or whatever. As long as you surrender to the Lord, that takes care of everything. But of course, in surrender to the Lord, then you will do certain activities in certain ways. And this, of course, may mean either don't fight or fight, depending on the Lord's will. So in the material world, we will also encounter many problems which look insurmountable from our tiny point of view, our relative point of view. What choice to make, how to get out of this particular problem. And we don't know. Another person may look at the problem and find a very easy solution from his point of view. From our point of view, no, but from his point of view, yes, it's very easy. So each person in the material world is stuck in a particular situation and from a particular perspective, and he gets caught up in that particular maya and he can't find a solution to that. Another person may find a solution, and yet there are other problems again that nobody can find a solution to. And people can argue back and forth forever on this and never come to a conclusion. So this is the nature of material world. So we do have guidelines in terms of scripture of what is right and wrong, but still we may come up with puzzling situations like this. And what is the right action to take? We don't know. So in all cases, no, we can use our intelligence for all of these situations, but at the same time, we should actually understand the main principle is that surrender to the Supreme Lord. So this, of course, is also the principle presented in Bhagavatam. We have different types of rules and regulations and different types of processes. So we have the social process of Dharma with all its rules and regulations. So that is sufficient to cover normal actions in the material world, how to interact with family, with extended family, with social groups, society, with government, with king, etc. So things are clearly defined, what the rights are and what you do and what you don't do. Laws and rules and regulations are made, or actions. The peculiarity of Dharma in India, the Vedic Dharma, is that the rules and regulations differ for different people. So therefore we get different varnas and different ashrams with different sets of rules, which is a little bit foreign to the modern world, where the set of rules is applied to everybody. Everybody has the same set of rules. But in the Varnashram system, no. Different people have different sets of rules to follow. So the Brahmins had one set, the Sudras had another set, the Vaishyas had one set, and the Kshatriyas had another set. And then, of course, we have subsets of that. In the Vaishya communities, we have so many groups, or in the Brahmin community, we have so many groups. Also, you know, the particular rules. So we get a very complex system of rules and regulations there, which works in most cases. And when there is a problem, then we have to have somebody to figure out what is the best solution. So therefore we do have systems of law and courts and kings to make judgments on, you know, what to do in that particular situation. So that covers normal transactions in terms of scriptural life. We follow the principles of Varnashram and whatever. That system cannot exist independent of Supreme Lord and Bhakti. Okay? So life is given to that system by worship of the Lord. Okay? So if we separate the principle of recognition of the Supreme Lord and obedience to the Supreme Lord from that system, it won't work properly. So what will happen is that people will operate in the gunas, and eventually one group will exploit the other group, and we'll end up with a normal materialistic society, which will end up, you know, with all sorts of divisions and dissension. So the unifying principle behind it, which makes it work in harmony, is that there is respect for the Supreme Lord, worship of the Supreme Lord. And therefore in the Bhagavad Gita, a very simple principle is enunciated in the third chapter, which deals with karma yoga and how to be happy in this material world. And that is that along with all the rules and regulations, the principle is that you have to sacrifice. That which means yajna means worship. Worship means offer to the Supreme Lord. So you offer to the Supreme Lord, recognize the Supreme Lord, and then the Lord responds to that and gives you something. Of course, we have the idea of we worship the Lord and then we get rain. The rain produces food. So that's one aspect, the food aspect. But not only the food aspect. We worship the Lord, then actually the Lord is in control of everything. He's in control of all the devatas and he's in control of all the material elements. So he takes care of society and generally makes arrangements for that because we give respect to the Lord. So in other words, he assists us in our whatever work we're doing in the material world. He helps our endeavors to reach perfection. But because there is the recognition of the Lord, that the arrangements are made in such a way that there's harmony within society. And when we do give up that, everyone becomes very selfish and they work for themselves and society falls apart. That, of course, is a basic fault that we'll find with all modern societies. As Prabhupada said, nobody likes war, nobody likes dissension, quarrel, etc. So they had wars, then they made a United Nations, and then the result of that is they still had wars. And they had more nations. They divided up further. And they continually divide up further and further and further. We find that like Yugoslavia divided up into about 6 countries, and every year a new country is formed out of Yugoslavia until there's nothing left eventually. So things keep dividing up further and further rather than getting unity as we go through the years, and we're supposed to progress as, you know, evolution, so to speak. You know, human society should progress nicely. Instead, we divide each other. We keep dividing up and having more dissension. So there's a problem in spite of the fact that we don't like wars and division, etc. We can't help it. So what this means is that there is this tendency in the human being, we could say it's maybe natural or whatever, it's just there, and that is tendency of greed and selfishness and lust and desire for enjoyment, etc. Desire for myself, desire for my family, desire for my country over this country or whatever. So all that type of me and mine mentality, based upon ahankara, is very difficult to get rid of. And that's proved by the situation in the material world. And no one can solve the problem. It continues to go on in spite of the fact that we don't like war and we're trying to have peace or whatever. It keeps going on. Nobody can stop it. So the solution of Bhagavatam is that how to get rid of that selfish nature. They don't deal with that in the material world, really. They just have some laws, and you're supposed to follow the laws, but they don't have a law how to get rid of your ahankara. That's not there in the material world. So that actually is the cause. You know, we have the material world, we have people acting with desire in the material world and doing activities right or wrong, sinful or not sinful or whatever, and getting the karma, and causing further problems in the material world by that. And above that, above the desire is avidya, ignorance. This is the cause. From avidya, then we get the papbija, and then we get our desires and whatever, and then our actions and our karma. So above everything is a subtle cause, that is avidya, which means our ignorance, that thinks of the material body and we want to enjoy in the material world. So that is why these systems never work, because the problem of our ignorance is not addressed properly. And if we don't do that, then no matter what solution we come to, that ignorance is going to interfere with everything and break the system down again. So it is difficult to get rid of ignorance in the jiva, because the jiva is what anadi bahir mukha. Without beginning, he's been in this position of opposing the Lord. It's difficult to get rid of that. Life after life, for every day of Brahma and every life of Brahma and previous life of Brahma and previous life of Brahma, each jiva is got this identity of me and mine. So it's very difficult to erase that in one sense because of the conditioning. Yet it also is possible by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So though the jivas are stuck in this position, the Supreme Lord, because he's blissful, his nature is ananda, he desires that ananda for the jivas in the material world. And therefore, he provides methods for the jivas to get out of their conditioning, hopeless conditioning. So, yes, it is hopeless, but by the mercy of the Lord, we can get out of this position. So, of course, mercy of the Lord is not something the Lord just says, I bless you, and everybody gets out of the material world. It makes it a little more difficult for us, or gives a little challenge. Sometimes he does that, as in the case of Putana or Agasura or whatever, and just kills them and that's finished. And they get their blessing and they get liberated from karma. But in most cases that is not so. So the Lord also expects each jiva to do a little work. So he provides different methods. One, of course, is after the material world is created, and then Brahma creates the planets, and then gives the bodies to the jivas, and according to the karma previous karma from previous creation, previous universe. Then he sticks the jivas, his all bodies, in different planetary systems in the universe. And then they do with their karmas and they do activities. So, what does the Lord do? He establishes the lowest level, that is Dharma, by having Swayambhuva Manu at the beginning of the day start a line of kings and establishing the principles of Dharma. So basic rules and regulations are given. Don't do this, do this. This is sinful, this is not sinful. This is piety, this is sin. All these rules and regulations are enforced, and we have the whole system of Arnashram Dharma there, and the kings enforce it, coming from Manu. So Manu is a jiva, but Manu is also a vibhuti of the Lord. That means he's not like as strong as a Shaktivesh avatar, they're eternal. But the Manus are given temporary powers as vibhutis, like the devatas or the sages. They're also vibhutis of the Lord. So they're given special powers by the Lord to rule and establish Dharma, just as the sages are given particular types of knowledge. And the devatas are given powers to bestow material benefits on the jivas. So the kings are there. They are bestowed power to institute Dharma for the human population. And so they do that throughout the reign of 71 yuga cycles, and then another Manu takes over and rules for 71 yuga cycles, etc. And in that process, of course, then we have another interesting factor. That is, the Lord himself appears as avatar and rules over the Manu also. In the Manavatara period for 71 yuga cycle, there is an avatar of the Lord who stays and supervises everything also. So he gets the assistance on that. For Yajna is the avatar, Manavatara avatar, then. That's why in Buddha's period. And Vamana is the present Manvatara avatar, Vaivasvata Manvatara. So we have an avatar always existing in the material world, helping out the jivas and the kings. And that's one system, that is regular Dharma. But as we know, Dharma is not bhakti, there's a difference. Dharma is there to satisfy everybody in the material world, and everybody's not a devotee. They're more interested in living in the material world and supporting their family and living a happy, peaceful life. That's what they want. So you can also do that, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. You follow the system and you can be happy in the material world. Yeah? You can get the blessings of the Lord to live happily in this material world if you follow the system of karma yoga. Follow the rules and regulations properly, obey the king, whatever. Yeah? And you can have your family live peacefully for generation after generation. Yeah? You do your work, you get the results, you follow rules and regulations, peaceful, there's no interruption due to nature or whatever, everything's harmonious, and you survive very nicely. Yeah? And the king protects you from demons and whatever. So that is a normal situation in the material world for society in general. And there is a spiritual element. I said you cannot exist, this society cannot exist without worship of the Lord. And therefore, the Supreme Lord puts the kings there, and the kings are Dharmic kings, and they also worship the Lord, because they're the vibhutis of the Lord, like the devatas. They all know the Lord. So there's some inherent bhakti to some degree within the system because of that. But it is not, it is, let's say, a lesser degree, because the main interest is keeping society together, rather than liberating everybody from society. So, of course, in that system we have various ways in which we go beyond the materialism, and that, of course, as we see with the idea of ashramas. Yeah? So if you're in a particular ashrama, there's a spiritual element there. If you're a brahmachari, then you have to read the Vedas, you have to study the Vedas, so then you have to get some spiritual knowledge that way. That knowledge carries over into your grihastha life. And then after a while, then you're supposed to renounce that life again and start practicing spiritual life more seriously as a vanaprastha. And if you're very qualified, then you take sannyas and give up everything and go for moksha. Get out of the material world. But it's more, it's a gradual process. It's not directly said everybody has to go for moksha. If you're qualified, then you eventually end up in that position and trying to get out of the material world. At the same time, we see the system is a little bit, let's say, materially inclined, because most of the population are sudras, and sudras can't even study the Vedas. So they don't become brahmacharis and they don't get that spiritual knowledge. They're just, you know, working in the material world and raising their families. But there is a smaller section, a small section, which is actually working towards liberation, particularly the brahminical community. Of those, some will take sannyas and go for liberation. So some small percentages there. Nevertheless, the system is built like this so that, you know, there is a push towards liberation eventually. Of course, Lord Chaitanya says that artha, dharma, kama, moksha, okay, fine, moksha is there, but that's not the goal either. There's a fifth goal called prema, which isn't mentioned in the Varnashram system. So that is the actual goal. In other words, yes, there is recognition of the Lord, recognition of spiritual life, etc. But prema, that relationship with the Supreme Lord, is not emphasized to a high degree. So yes, there is bhakti within the system to make it work, recognition of the Lord, but it is not a dominant factor. So, therefore, we do have karma yoga as one system for the population in general, and then as an offshoot of that, we get jnana for liberation. If you become brahminical or sannyasi or whatever, or vanaprastha, then you can go for liberation, or yogi or whatever. So, there is some bit like that, but still, it doesn't directly mention prema in that system. So therefore, we have karma yoga and jnana yoga and astanga yoga, but it's incomplete. We need bhakti yoga also. So that is the final process, the highest process, beyond this whole system of other yogas. So that is the distinction. We can talk about dharma, etc., which includes a little bhakti, but we actually want bhakti in which the goal is prema. That's what we want. Not that bhakti is there and we're just trying to use that to be happy in the material world. So that system of bhakti has to be clearly defined. So that is what the Bhagavatam does. It separates bhakti from everything else and clearly defines its difference and different method and different goal. So it's not just recognition of the Lord, but actually we have certain activities which directly produce bhakti and directly produce prema. So we have in hearing, chanting, remembering, worshipping the deity. These are direct processes which give us prema. So this is the main difference, that we have this system to get prema, the other system is there to survive in the material world and ultimately simply get out of the material world and get liberation. So that is the whole system. So the Varnashram system gives us very useful rules, definitely, for doing things. And therefore, in bhakti yoga, we don't necessarily reject the rules of dharma. They are, to some extent, favorable. Some aspects of it are not favorable, like worship of devatas, etc. So we don't accept those principles. Other principles are favorable. So we find, for instance, in the Bhagavatam, the first canto, in the story of Parikshit and Kali, then we find the symbol of the bull with the four legs. So we have the principles of dharma. So upon that we base our regulative principles, which we practice. So those things are favorable for devotional development. So we accept them and we follow them. At the same time, we should also understand that those principles are not bhakti in the real sense, that they do not give bhakti. For just being a vegetarian does not make you a devotee. Many impersonalists are vegetarians. Many atheists may be vegetarians, but that doesn't produce bhakti as such. Whereas a person chants the name of the Lord, then directly he increases his bhakti by that. So those processes which directly will what invoke Krishna's bhakti shakti and have it increase within the atma, those processes are what we call bhakti. The other things which are favorable are there, but they may not produce bhakti themselves, but they will help to cultivate that bhakti and increase that bhakti. Because if we don't follow those principles, we do the opposite. There's very negative effects on developing bhakti. So there are things which are favorable in the Varnashram system. We follow those things, like cleanliness, etc. Cleanliness, non-violence, etc. We follow those rules. And if you have a family, then what rules to follow? Just everybody chant Hare Krishna. Doesn't always work. So there are rules there. Rules for the husband and wife interaction, rules for the children, etc. All the different relationships are clearly defined. What duties everyone has in the system. So it's helpful to have a clear idea of who's supposed to do what. What the role of everybody is in the family. So we accept those rules. As much as one has a family. If one doesn't have a family, you don't need those rules. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that these are what we call gona vidhi. We have the mukhya vidhi. Those are the things that directly produce bhakti. Then we have supporting rules that we can follow, taken mainly from the Varnashram system. So they're called gona vidhi, secondary rules. And so they're also helpful. At a certain point, they may not have too much significance anymore. Yeah? So as one advances in bhava and prema, and then those devotees may even forget about those rules too. They're not concerned with those rules, because those rules actually have something to do with their existence in the material world and our material body. Yeah? So they become completely transcendental to their material body. They forget about their material body, so those rules also are forgotten. So that is why it is said that the person in bhava and prema, we should not judge them, because they may not follow our rules. they do something contrary to what we think is a good rule to follow. Yeah? Very difficult to understand the activities of a person in prema. Yeah? That is Rupa Goswami's comment there in the Nectar Devotion. Yeah? You cannot understand his conduct, because what we may think is right and wrong, whatever, is not his principle anymore. He's beyond that. But as far as people doing sadhana bhakti, yes, as much as possible we can follow those rules and regulations which are favorable for our devotional development and our social development, whatever, then help us. So we can follow them. But we should also clearly make a distinction between the bhakti part and the other part. Between the mukhya vidhi and the gona vidhi, the principal rules of bhakti and others. So the emphasis we have to put upon the mukhya vidhi, the main rules of bhakti, the main principles of bhakti. And that is how we develop our devotional service. So the situations here where we find problems due to conflicts and the rules, which rule to follow. We follow the rules that the principles that are presented here with Draupadi, or we follow the other principles that Bhima or Arjuna would say, kill Aswatthama or whatever. So ultimately, as I said, if we take shelter of bhakti, then we can have a proper solution to everything. That will solve all of our problems. Though we have many problems in the material world, if we surrender to the Supreme Lord and take shelter of Him, that will be the ultimate solution to our problem. We can take help of, guidance of these rules, whatever, but ultimately, main principle is surrender to Krishna. Any question?
On the topic of Jagya, in the third chapter of the Gita, Krishna's main objective is to induce Arjuna to engage in the fight. So does he bring up the point of Jagya? For a Brahman that would be, Puja Mama. So it's for a Kshatriya, he's fighting Jagya.
In that particular case, that Yagya, he said, what Yagya is Vishnu and means make an offering to the Lord, and then the Lord supplies the rain, and then you get the food, and then because you get the food, you get nourished. When you get nourished, then you can study the Vedas more, and you can do more sacrifice. So it looks particularly, it means worship itself. So, yes, the Brahmanas are the main persons to do it, but that does not mean that a Vaishya or a Kshatriya cannot worship also. For instance, the king can sponsor a yagya. So that's his contribution. He sponsors the Brahmins to do the yajna or whatever. And of course, yajna also means not just homa. It also means worship itself. So worship of any form, offering of any form to the Lord, constitutes yajna. So we have Sankirtan yajna, for instance, and that's an offering to the Lord, though it's not a homa. Still, it is an offering of the name to the Lord, by glorifying the Lord. Or deity worship, again, is yajna in the sense it's worship, that we're offering things to the Lord for His pleasure. It's a particular system called archana. So in the broad sense, they're all yajna. Whether, you know, that he's referring only to homa there or not, it's a little unclear. But we do see in other places he does particularly concentrate on things like that, where he talks about the mantra and the, you know, the offering into the fire and the ghee and etc. He also does that. So he does also have interest particularly in yajna. In any case, all the persons can participate somehow or other, if not directly, then indirectly by sponsoring. So even the Vaishya can sponsor or whatever, or the Kshatriya can sponsor it. So in any case, they must recognize the Supreme Lord in that system.
Gopal was on the side of Lord Krishna, but the way it comes across is that not because of any special affection for the Lord, but mainly his motive was to kill Drona. And there an old score with Drona. So how do we understand people who were on the Pandava side, but who were not on the Pandava side because of
out of affection, but out of some other reasons? Well, we can take that just like we have mixed bhakti or whatever, and people have motives by which they approach Krishna. We have those who want material things, those who want to get rid of their distress, so they surrender to Krishna. So similarly, he sided with Krishna because he had some personal problem he wanted to solve, so we can say it's a material motive, but nevertheless he chose Krishna to do that. So that was to his benefit, we could say, because of that. So somehow or other you approach Krishna, it's good. That's obviously not the purest of motives, but nevertheless, you know, he sided with Krishna.
You mentioned that the Srimad Bhagavatam contributes or provides that element of bhakti which is not directly there in the Vayana system. The Srimad Bhagavatam kind of like contributes that.
Yeah.
So, the process of doing that, is it simply we just Bhagavat Shravan, you just that is bhakti, or is it meant that it's like a guideline, almost like replacing Vayana Shravan, the instructions of bhakti?
It replaces it?
Well, it's like it becomes a guideline, it becomes like, you know, the neon, the vidi for the bhaktas rather than the dhanasya. Or is it you just hear Bhagavatam, there's nothing on no other issue, it's just Bhagavat Shravan, that's bhakti in itself.
And what, we ignore everything else?
Well, it's just that, I mean, it's not really a matter of as a guidebook, but it's just you sit and hear Bhagavatam and that service as bhakti.
Oh, well, let's say it's the final authority for our activities. It does not exclude other activities, because we see that, for instance, there these devotees are following within the some sort of system also, even though they're devotees. So it doesn't make us reject everything completely. But the principle is that the main element is that the let's say the vidis of bhakti, such as hearing and chanting, that's our, and our goal through that is to attain eternal service to Krishna. And everything is secondary to that. We may or may not follow according to our condition. So in other words, we're not absolute. Whereas someone who's on the karma yoga platform, he is so attached to those rules, he'll never give them up. But for the devotee, he may or may not follow according to his particular position. Some will follow out of some slight attachment. Some will follow because simply to set an example for others who are on a lower level. And others will give them up. So that is why Balda Vijayabhushan, he classifies the three types of devotees, the Safeksha, the Parinishita, and the Nirapeksha. Nirapeksha doesn't do anything. He's just beyond the rules. He's like a Prem Bhakta or Bhav Bhakta or something like that, and just worshipping the Lord. Then we have the Parinishita devotee, who follows to some extent, not because he's attached, but simply because other people are there and he should set an example, as with the Pandavas or something like that. And then there's the Sanishta, who also follows, but he's somewhat attached to the rules and regulations also, though he's also a devotee. So he's not a mixed devotee also, we can say, not in normal sense, but he's somewhat attached to the rules and regulations. But he's also, you know, following the major vidhis of bhakti as well. So three types of devotees. And below that we have the people who are just attached to the following the rules of Varnashram Dharma in a particular varna or whatever. In Baladeva Vidyabhusan's commentary in the Gita and also in his commentary in the Brahma Sutras. Let me forget about all this Sandhya Vandana and Pitra Yagya and all these things, Tarpanas.
How do we understand also for us what Maharaja Puri said, he can give up that?
Yeah, so he's like the Nirapeksha devotee.
So
he's completely absorbed in the Lord.
Do you believe that?
Well, whatever is favorable and without contradiction. If it's worship of Devatas, we don't generally do, except if we recognize them as devotees of the Lord and offer Krishna Prasad to them, then we can do. Or the same with the Pitras or whatever. Then we can do to some extent, but we should not be overly attached to it. We should not think, if I don't do it, then I'm very sinful, or I go to hell, or whatever.
So before that, it was not in a written format. So what was the access for the previous Yuga people for Bhagavad?
Oh, Bhagavad, well, see, the Puranas were only written by Vyasadeva at the end of Dwarpa Yuga. So there is no Puranas before then. They just have the Vedas. And of course, the Mahabharata also, again, written by Vedavyas at the end of Dwarpa Yuga for the people of Kali Yuga. For the women and sudras or whatever. So for the less intelligent people of Kali Yuga, these works are up here. So in previous yugas, they simply have the Vedas carried on by the sages in their particular lines of whatever. And even then, it's one Veda, not four Vedas, because Vedavyas divides the Vedas into four also at the beginning, just before Kali Yuga starts. So it's a one Veda, a very vast subject, and it's transmitted by sages. So that is their that aspect of spiritual life carried on by that method.
Different yuga cycles are also happening. How do you understand that the Satyuga, Dwapara Yuga is again and again coming? So that means that every Dwapara Yuga, this will be, maybe the previous yuga cycle, this Purana has existed again.
So it is said that, persons like Vyasa come every Dwarpa Yuga. So every Dwarpa Yuga they will come and they will start writing Puranas. But it won't be exactly the same because the history is not exactly the same. There's, of course, general similarities, but not everything is the same. So same with Mahabharata and everything. So they keep writing these works with, according to the local history. Some details are going to change.
As Satama becomes the next Vyasadeva, he's still on the planet.
Why he's so elevated? I have no idea why, but somehow he's got the blessing or the curse of living that long, and then he becomes the next Vyasadeva. And the next Manu is also somewhere around. The last, descendant of the last of the Manu's reign. He's there and he's somewhere up in the Himalayas. And then he manifests himself when Satyuga starts and starts the Varnashram system again. Lines of Manu continue again. Because we see that in Bhagavan it traces how the whole line gets corrupted after Krishna's disappearance and everything just kind of disintegrates and everybody assassinates everybody and sudras take control of the government, etc. So the lines of kings disappear. They come from Manu. So therefore, there is a descendant who's sitting there in the Himalaya somewhere, and then he manifests himself at the beginning of Satyuga again, after 400,000 years. So there are people up there just waiting for different roles, but why Asvatthama particularly, I don't know, it's hard to say.
Maharaj, you said there are different roots in the Vedas, but ultimately we surrender to Krishna.
Yeah.
So, just on this story, in a few verses before, where Krishna says and to Arjuna that to kill Ashwatthama, but still out of Krishna's feeling. So, how do you understand this? Krishna's instruction to kill Ashwatthama?
Yeah, okay. Well, we can say that's more or less a test. It's a test thing, huh? A test question or whatever like that, and we'll see how everybody reacts. So obviously, Draupadi doesn't react in the same way as one would expect. So, yeah. So though Krishna says this, it's more or less a test command to see how everyone's going to react.
These five children who are killed.
I don't know if there's any history, not like the sons of Vasudeva and all that, how they were, you know, that was a history with that. So five sons, I don't know. It probably is somewhere, but I don't know about it.
As you were mentioning that during every Manvantara, he needs over 71 yoga cycles.
Yeah.
During that, there is an avatar of the Lord that comes, and right now it's Vaman Dev,
yeah,
come to oversee those 71 yoga cycles. So, yeah. What category of avatars would that fall under?
They're called Manvantara avatars. So there's 14 Manvantara avatars in one day of Brahma. But the Manvantara may also be a Leela avatar. So Vaman is also a Leela avatar, but he's also a Manvantara avatar. Sometimes there is Manvantara avatars, and they don't do anything else. Other times they're also a Leela avatar and they do particular things like Vamana, you know, defeats Bali, etc.
Then what is Vaivasvata called? Is he not a Manvantara?
No, he is the king. He is the Manu who is a particular jiva who has particular powers, whereas Vamana is the avatar, he's Supreme Lord. It's not a jiva.
So all these Manvantaras, like Swayambhu and
Manvantara is the period. Manu is the jiva, who is the king, and the Manvantara avatara is the avatar provides over the Manvantara period. He is the avatar of the Supreme Lord. Yagya and Swayambhuva Manvantara was there, and I think Hari ruled in which one? I think the second or third one. He manifested as also in the Hichandra Moksha, I think, as Hari. He's a Manvantara avatar. Ajita, in Chakshusha Manvantara, before Vaivasvata Manvantara, Ajita, who sat on top of the Mandara, with the churning of the Mandara Mountain in the Milky Ocean, he sat on top of it, and it was Ajita. He's a Manvantara avatar for Chakshusha Manvantara. So there's 14. They're mentioned in the... A lot of them are mentioned in the 8th canto, the future ones. Now we're halfway through the day of Brahma. So there's 7 more in the future. So those are mentioned in the 8th canto of Bhagavatam, the future ones.
Okay.